So we got this question in the Discord by VST Hero. Dan, I wanted to ask you about the stereogram strategies you used while painting. I was reading a short chapter from a teacher who described field-based attention as a strategy for attending to a classroom rather than focused attention, which seemed to cause much more fatigue. I find I have a tendency toward hyperfocus in most activities and can often only work for 2 to 3 hours in this way most days before my endurance is gone. I wanted to circle back to the episode where you and Mike discussed this and actually try a new approach. So, Mike, I'm wondering if you can kind of summarize what we're thinking for this episode.
Yeah, I think we have to give a bit of context because there's been a few different thought lines and episodes that lead into this a little bit. Probably it might be weird to have a favorite episode of something that we did. So maybe that's, I don't know. It's my favorite.
I don't think
though.
It's that weird.
Okay. Where we talked about Puzzle Storm. Do you remember this?
I do. Yes. I don't know if anyone else remembers, but I do.
Yeah. I actually think we got some pretty good responses to that one. It seemed like a lot of people were pretty excited about what we talked about there. So, okay. Puzzle Storm is a practice mode in Lee Chess, which is, if you haven't used it, is similar to chess.com. It's like this online or in an app chess. You can play chess against people. You can do training things. It has a mode called Puzzle Storm. And Puzzle Storm, I don't remember the exact details because I haven't played it in a while, but you essentially solve chess puzzles against the clock. And I think you get a little bit of extra time when you get a puzzle correct, but you're just trying to race through these puzzles as fast as you can. And a chess puzzle is basically, you see the chessboard, and you have to find the best move. And we got on this line of thinking because we read an article from this guy who had used Puzzle Storm as kind of his main training tool for chess, and saw this tremendous improvement in his chess score, or his like chess ranking. And he had been trying to improve it for a while, but this was the thing that just worked really well. So we both got interested and started playing this and started thinking about what's happening there. So presumably the reason why Puzzle Storm can work so well for improving your chess game, you would think, if I want to get better at beating people at chess, I should just play chess. And there's probably some truth to that, but this seems to work really well. And presumably the reason is that when you're solving chess puzzles, first, if you're doing it at your leisure, you have a puzzle in front of you and you have infinite time, figure out what the best move is, you tend to look at the board and kind of think through things. Where you see a piece, you look at it, you look at where it can go, you think, okay, is this a strong move? Is that a strong move? Nah, it doesn't really look like it. You sort of focus on the next one and you kind of laser in your focus on a piece of the board, really examine it, and then go to the next thing. But in Puzzle Storm, you can't do that because you're trying to get this done as fast as you can. So it doesn't matter if you slowly work your way to the right answer. You need to see the right answer as fast as you possibly can. So instead of having to do this laser focus, you just see the board. And it's almost this innate reflexive thing where your eyes just kind of catch the right move. You go, oh, here's a fork, or ah, here's a pin or something. And I barely even remember chess terminology because we aren't actually chess players. It was just an interesting thing. But that was Puzzle Storm.
Well, wait. You're describing it as, you know, chess puzzles, and you sit down and you do chess puzzles. But Puzzle Storm is you load it up and the timer starts counting down and you just have to go. Like, it's really, really fast.
Right.
And it's frantic. You're dropped into the middle of this game where all the pieces are in random places and you just, oh my God, I got to figure it out. And the timer is counting down and it's this panic mode. And you have to see the whole board and think through it really quickly. It's not like this, oh, I'm doing chess puzzles. It's this,
right.
I don't know. It's this right. Heart attack. And, yeah.
And it's really fun. I really enjoyed it. I like just pulling it out and doing some Puzzle Storm. But it does, at first it feels uncomfortable because you want to sit there and think and focus and really reason your way through. It doesn't really feel very good to just do what kind of feels like a guess, where you just move a piece thinking, I think it's this, I think it's that. It doesn't really feel like the right thing, but it trains this ability in your mind to just see the board and the moves start to just kind of pop out. It's like you aren't really looking at individual pieces. You're seeing the board, and you just that move kind of highlights itself in your field of view. And this is a I got really excited about this, and I think some other people did too. And we never really followed up on this all that much. We didn't circle the conversation back, and I really want to. So I'm excited for this episode. Okay, there's that. The other little piece of this, I actually don't think this was the same episode. Maybe it was a, I think it was a more recent one. But you were recommending to me to try doing the Magic Eye, I don't know what they're, the Magic Eye thing.
Auto-stereograms.
Auto-stereogram. Okay. And the way those work, for anybody who did not grow up in the 90s, is you see this picture and it looks a little bit like TV static or something. It's all these shapes that are kind of pulled apart and particleized and everything. It doesn't really look like anything. But if you stare at it and you essentially separate the focus of your eyes, where you're kind of looking through it at some focal point in the distance, then parts of the image kind of converge and it pops out this 3D shape.
Oh, there's no way it's going to show up on camera.
Yeah, unless you have auto
auto
exposure.
But yeah, you hold it.
Yeah.
Keep talking. I'm just going to do this.
Let us know what it is when you see it. You would see these in random, I don't know, restaurants, and it was this little bit of a craze for a while. But you had recommended to me to do this as a, I think I was working on some StarCraft stuff and I was talking about how I kept getting fixated and overfocused on something. And you were like, oh, try this. It's a, so I can't talk while you're doing this. Does it work?
Keep, I've almost got it. Just keep talking.
All right. You had recommended this to me as a training method to try and get yourself to defocus your eyes. And you had said that somebody like athletes or somewhere in the world, people were using this as a training tool. So that's kind of where that came from.
This one's basically nothing. It's like just a dent.
You just can't do it.
Which is really stupid.
No,
I did it. I did it. It's just stupid. I just randomly downloaded a couple of them. I won't do any more. But yeah, so my friend was... Actually, I didn't think of this. I was talking to my friend about how I was having trouble kind of focusing too much on details when I was going to my life drawing class. And, you know, you end up with bad proportions and your figures look weird and awful because you pay attention to the wrong things or at the wrong time. So I was, you know, describing this problem that I was having, and he's like, you know, he kind of used it as an example of, you know, sometimes they train athletes with these auto-stereograms to kind of learn what the feeling is to visually see the whole picture. You know, so you, it's very hard to explain, but basically if you've ever tried an auto stereogram, you have to, or if you've ever successfully done an auto stereogram, you have to like relax your eyes and look past it and kind of just focus on keeping your eyes sort of zoned out. It's a weird feeling. But anyway, apparently they use that, or they have used that as a way to train athletes to see the whole field, to kind of see the whole picture. And so I got a little into that and I started downloading them and just, you know, playing around with them. And I was going around work showing people. I found that some people literally cannot see them because of slight eye visual impairments and stuff.
Oh, really?
And it was kind of sad to watch some people just sit there for 15 minutes and never be able to see it. But
as far as they know, everybody else is just jerking them around pretending they can see something.
Yes, and that's what most people say. You show them this, and they're like, there's nothing there. There's nothing. Oh, I see it. It's a shark. And
yeah,
a lot of that. And I got a lot of headaches, and it hurt my eyes if you do them too much. But yeah, so I got kind of into this idea of auto-stereograms, and I don't know. I found that when I went back to class and I started trying to see the whole picture, it was that feeling. It was that exact feeling that I had when I was looking at the auto stereograms. And so it was just kind of this, that's interesting. Like, this is a weird, goofy 90s gimmick thing, and it actually has some use, at least in, it's not like this big secret or big solution to everything, but it was just this interesting, I don't know, that's weird that it's the same function happening, or it's very similar.
Yeah, I got kind of really into that idea, so I spent way too much time setting up this whole software thing, like program that would take an image, it would use an AI to build a depth map out of the image. And there's a couple AI models that are actually pretty good at this, where it gives you this grayscale image that it tries to figure out like which piece of the image is closest to you and which is farthest away. And then I would feed that into this random noise generator stereogram program that would like take the depth map from the image and create an auto stereogram, and then it would show it to me. And so the idea would be that I could do this just endlessly by cranking it through just a whole folder full of downloaded images or random things off the internet, and they would all just pop up as an auto stereogram. I was thinking, I'm gonna do this all day long every day. So I got very into it. The program I wrote didn't work all that well. It did work, but it was like the depth just wasn't quite what I wanted, and a lot of times you would see like the ground of the image really close to you and then the subject far away, which is sort of
Yeah.
correct, but not really what you would want to see. So anyway, not that anyone cares about that
You
weird experiment.
should have sent those to me or shared them somehow, but okay.
I might dig it up. It's somewhere on my hard drive. I think it still works. Anyway, I experiment with this a lot, and I found it. So I have thought about and practiced this concept consistently since we talked about it, since the Puzzle Storm episode, trying to see, what did VST Hero call it? Field-based vision, I
Yeah,
think.
field-based attention.
Okay, field-based
Yeah.
attention. Yeah, that's a great term for it. So I have practiced this a
Versus,
lot.
sorry, versus focused
Yeah,
attention. So
yeah.
field-based attention, focused attention. Yeah.
Yeah. In regards to the auto stereogram stuff, I did not find a huge benefit from just doing that, like doing it every morning or something. I didn't walk around going, oh, I get it now. I have
Yeah.
field-based attention. But I found it very useful as this sort of almost demonstration to yourself of, hey, this is a way of perceiving things that is somewhat counter to what you find instinctual. Like these auto stereograms, it's weird because you're having to defocus your eyes and stereo separate your vision. I'm not sure what you would call it, but like you're not converging your eyes on this point right in front of you. You're converging them on something much farther away. But at the same time, you're trying to see what you're looking at. It's not like you're just staring off into space and you're not really processing your vision. Like you can do that. You can stare out the window and everything just kind of gets a little fuzzy, and you're not really paying attention to anything. In this case, you're having to do this with your eyes, but you are looking at something. So it's this weird hybrid of bringing your attention to a specific thing, but not having the focus of your eyes follow that attention directly. And I think that is extremely key to the field-based attention, and trying to use this in other contexts. Like I don't care that much about chess, and I'm not trying to spend my life looking at auto stereograms, but for other things, and I want to talk about some of those things in a minute, I've found this to be an unbelievably powerful concept. And I think it ties into what VST Hero was kind of asking about, which was fatigue. And I think that's a whole nother dimension of this, but he was hoping to find a way of dealing with a classroom and not getting completely burnt out after 2 or 3 hours, which is, I'm not in front of a classroom, but I have struggled a lot with just making it through a workday, doing much of anything without getting really fatigued. I feel like I burn myself out really fast, and I think this is a piece of that. So.
Yeah, and just to be clear, when I was getting and still am excited about auto stereograms, it's not so much that the act of doing them itself, it's not like a meditation or something. It doesn't weave its way into everything in life, but it is this really cool, like you said, demonstration of this visual thing that weirdly affects your mental state, kind of heavily. And it's cool to see that happen.
Yeah, so I highly recommend, just type in auto stereogram or magic eye to Google, and you'll see plenty of images,
Yeah.
and it like at least play around with it to discover this kind of focus state or mind state. So okay, let's kind of get into some of how this this works. I think there's a few, I don't know, different ideas here that get a little bit overlapped, and I want to try and separate them a little and then talk about like how this is useful to you or, yeah. or can be. I want to talk about art. Cool. On your recommendation, yeah, figured. I bought this book, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. I think I mentioned it last week. I've started doing it, and it's great. It's really good. It's very beginner focused. I mean, you're kind of expected to be a rank beginner. But the
wait,
the whole...
hold on. To anyone who hasn't listened to us before, Mike is not the artist.
Yeah, one of us is an artist, and it's not me. Although yeah. soon I'm getting through this book, and I'm sure I'll be amazing. So this, I mean, you specifically recommended this to me, so presumably you understand the concept behind the book pretty well. I don't. I'm
getting
I went through it. Okay.
Yeah, I went through it years ago.
Yeah. So the premise of the book is that you have your right brain and your left brain, and your left brain is the logical, organized, conscious thinking one. We'll get to how this is bullshit in a second. You have your right brain, which is the creative one, the artsy one. It kind of sees everything in this fluid kind of way, but it's nonverbal. So yeah, it's sort of in the background a little bit, and you're dominated by your left brain most of the time. And so if you want to be a good drawer, then you gotta shut up the left side of the brain. And Betty Edwards calls it R mode, like right brain mode. You gotta get into R mode. And then your right brain is able to do all the drawing, and it can see things and proportions and space and curves and whatnot. And that's where the artist lies. So that's not true.
Well, this is the big controversy with the book, which I don't think we should really get into. But yeah. the terms she uses, a lot of people get very upset about, like, it's not really left brain, right brain. It's not, that's not what it is. And so people, you know, discount the book and what she talks about. And so, yeah, I recommended it. I'm not saying it's perfect science or whatever.
I feel like it has to be brought up, because you can't just talk about it and not acknowledge that it doesn't really work that way. To be fair to her, like, I mean, this was written in the 80s, I think. At the time, that is kind of what we thought. Like, there was science around that. There was some experimentation, and it really did seem like there was this big separation. Since then, it's kind of become clear that it's really not that literal of left brain, right brain. There's these different processes, whatever. It doesn't really matter where things are or if it even makes sense to think of these different ways of thinking in terms of physical locations in the brain. Whatever. Give it a name. If we want to call it R mode, we call it R mode, right?
Right.
What she's describing, she did a great job of having you do these exercises, and it really made it make sense. Like, I kind of got what she was trying to show you. So the first things you do in the book are you essentially copy portraits of people, which in terms of drawing has got to be one of the harder things, like drawing a person rather than a cube or something. So she has you copy these portraits, and you start out, like, at the very beginning, you just do it, and it sucks. And, you know, I'm drawing a person, and it looks awful, and I hate it, and it looks like a kid drawing.
Wait. Let's give a little context to you venturing into art. You, for your entire life, as far as I can remember, you've always seen yourself as someone who can only draw like a toddler would, right? Like, when I think of you drawing, I think of you hating the experience and getting really angry and upset because every time you draw it, it looks like a kid drew it or something. Like, when I picture you drawing or thinking of art, I just think of you getting really pissed off. All right. So that, I mean, to me, you are like the perfect example of someone who thinks that they were not born with the artist gene or whatever. Like, you,
okay, that's crossing the line, because...
Is it?
Yes, because I very much believe... I do not believe in the you're born of this.
No. Not anymore. But that mentality that you've had, or that attitude towards it, is...
That, yeah, I, and that I, could be.
Yes.
So regardless of how I used to be in terms of drawing or not, I've started doing the exercise in this book. You start out by just drawing something like a portrait of a person. It's terrible. It just looks like hardly better than a stick figure kind of thing with stupid hair and an awful face. It's just this horrible monster comes out of you of this person. And then she walks you through these exercises, kind of talks you through this way of seeing things. And then you have to copy these portraits, but they're upside down. You're not allowed to flip them over. You're not allowed to turn your paper over. You have your sketch pad and then the image next to you, and it's upside down. And if you've ever looked at a picture of somebody upside down, it doesn't happen often, especially a face or just something where you're really seeing the person. It looks very strange. Like, this, the face doesn't look like a face anymore. Everything just feels really foreign and strange. Like, it's just this random collection of appendages and eyeballs and stuff. And it's, for whatever reason, your brain just doesn't really process a face in the same way. It's used to seeing them face up. And you kind of, I don't know what the word is, like, your brain creates symbols for things. You know, you see a chair, you're not really seeing every detail and curve and really processing the shape. You're kind of just seeing chair and your brain fills it in. Like, yep, that's a chair, and oh, that's a tree, and you're not actually looking at it. So you have to copy this portrait upside down, and because your brain can't really resolve it in this symbolic way that it's used to, you kind of just see it like a bunch of lines and shapes, to where you're drawing a line and you're not really thinking, oh, this is a shoulder. It should look like a shoulder. Is that a shoulder? I don't know. And like the symbol resolving part of your brain isn't really that involved. It's kind of just a line. And so you're looking at it, and it really did feel like a bit of a transition here. But at first, I'm kind of focused on the line, and then I'm like trying, I don't know what to do here, whatever, I'm trying to copy this thing. But pretty quickly, you start to see, or you start to realize that if I'm drawing this line, the line itself doesn't matter all that much in a way. It's like, I don't need to put all my attention on my pencil just slowly moving across the page. What I'm trying to see is, how does this line relate to the lines around it? You know, first on the thing that I'm copying, and then also on my own drawing. So really, I'm trying to see the line compared to everything else, and I'm trying to see that compared to my own drawing, and the line compared to the things around it over here. And so you wind up with this very broad perception. You're trying to see the overall form and placement of things, and so your vision actually does start to get into this more field-based attention. And you start to let go of this symbol resolving part of your brain, and you're really just trying to see, okay, where does this line go relative to everything else? Is it midway between these two other points? Is it 2/3 of the way? What is the angle? And you're just seeing this whole thing, like big picture type of thing. And that one, I mean, it was brilliant of her to set up the beginning of the book this way, because you do your stupid drawing of a person, and then you do a couple of these and you compare them and you're like, holy crap, this is so much better. I can't believe that this drawing came out of me. I mean, it's not brilliant by any stretch, but it's like, it feels like a real thing. Like, hey, this actually looks very much like the portrait that I just copied. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, I went through the exact same thing when I did it for the first time. It's a weird thing to learn. Previously, before you do something like that, or before you come to that realization, you use a certain set of, I don't know, functions in your brain in order to do that. And they're typically just wrong. And so you can very easily decide, oh, I'm not an artist, you know.
Yeah.
Or if you, by chance, get it right, then you keep going with that. But you can easily be under the idea that you just can't do it if you're using the wrong functions in your brain. And so something like this kind of shows you. I don't know what you're doing.
Sorry, your cat is like really wanting attention. Or not attention. I don't know what she wants. This is Ruby.
She doesn't seem happy, but...
She's never happy. He like wants me to pay attention to her and then wants to be mad when I pay attention to her. It's just circle of life with her. So I feel like this mode of thinking is something you are, I imagine, pretty familiar with because you spend so much time as an artist. I'm kind of wondering how you would break it down. Like, this is sort of my first exposure to this from the art side. There's other areas where I've used this or been using it. But, I mean, is this something you find yourself doing a lot? Do you just naturally flip into a mode where you're seeing kind of everything? Or what is that like for you?
Well, first off, I'm speaking for me, but I imagine this applies to really all artists in differing levels. But this idea of going from theoretical left side or logical brain and where symbols are, and then going to the other side, that battle of trying to get to that other side is constant. I mean, I go through this every day. I go through it every time I pick up a pencil to draw. I imagine a lot of other artists can get into that state faster, but it's really kind of it's general knowledge that you do really bad drawings at the beginning. Like, whenever you pick up the pencil for the first time in the day, you're going to do a bad drawing. In fact, you might do many bad drawings. But after a while, you can typically, not always, but typically find your way to that other side or to the place where you need to go. It's not a switch you can just switch on and off. There are many tactics that artists use to get to that. And one thing that she talks about is dropping the verbal stuff in your brain. So you stop trying to think in words and you stop trying to think in symbols, and you slowly start to just kind of dive into this world of these weird subconscious feelings and spatial stuff and visual thinking. But there are so many different tactics. I mean, the turning the drawing upside down, that's sort of a hack to get out of the bad side of your brain. But a lot of artists will, they'll flip their canvases upside down and they'll flip their references while they're doing, an illustration or whatever. They will put it in the mirror. So that was a big thing back in the day. The artists of the past have always used mirrors to, like, you're doing your painting and then you have a big mirror behind you. You just turn around and look at it. It flips it. And so you're having to see it just like seeing the drawing upside down.
Yeah.
You're having to use, like, different functions all of a sudden. And all of those previous symbols that you had get thrown out the window. And now you're seeing it backwards. I was doing this for my latest painting. I would take a picture of it and then flip it with my phone. And you kind of hate to do it because you see how wrong or how bad it is instantly, or how just weird and awkward it looks, which is strange because it's just the same thing flipped. But it's really weird. You instantly notice all of these new things that are wrong with it. And so that's something that a lot of artists do. I mean, another thing they do is, this isn't actually very popular, but back in the day, they used to use this thing called a Lorraine mirror, which is basically a black mirror. And if you were, say, painting something outside, if you're, plein air painting or whatever, like a landscape, you look at the scene in front of you and it's bright and the colors are saturated and there's just detail everywhere. I mean, imagine yourself looking at a field with trees and architecture in the background. I mean, you start to look, you see every single leaf in that tree and the light is shimmering on each leaf and there's just all different types of greens and the wind is blowing. I mean, there's just so much detail going on. But if you look at the scene through this black mirror, this Lorraine mirror, it condenses it all down. It's like this meniscus shaped, right? Is that the right word?
Is it like a prism?
Like a little lens.
Okay, a lens, yeah.
Well, it's just like it's curved glass with a black backing. Okay. And you look at the scene through this black mirror, and it condenses the scene down to a really small size, and it darkens everything. And it simplifies, so in doing that, it simplifies the whole scene. So the big picture of that scene gets condensed into this little thing, and you can see it. It cuts out all the detail. And so you're able to see the big picture instead of getting lost in the detail. So that's one method that artists have used in the past. But basically, that idea of getting to the to the right or the correct side of the brain, is a battle that all artists kind of have to face if they're doing something sort of, or if they're trying to do realism type stuff, or you want it to look real, you have to overcome that symbolic side of your brain.
Is that why the show is called Black Mirror? Is it called Black Mirror, named after that Black Mirror?
I don't know. I haven't seen Black Mirror. I mean, I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it. It could be.
It kind of makes sense to me. It's the sort of holding up this lens to society that, you know, gives you this.
It could be.
Yeah, that actually fits really perfectly in my mind.
It's also why, I forget the name of it, but basically, one of the methods for copying something in front of you realistically is kind of putting a graph over it. And either in that book or in the Perspective Made Easy book that you also got, one of the exercises is to go to one of your windows with, I think they say a wax pencil. Yeah, because it's like early 1900s or something. But I used a dry erase marker. You go to the window, which is a flat 2D plane between you and the subject in the background, the landscape or whatever, and you trace the outlines or the contours of everything outside of the window with this dry erase marker or wax pencil or whatever. And you're condensing all that detail, all of that 3D space, all of those symbols that you have and all that craziness in the visual world, and you condense it to this exact flat plane, which is what you have to do when you draw anything. You have to translate your 3D world into 2D space. And it's amazing because it overrides all of these systems that you have in place and kind of shows you to, I don't know, simplify everything. So yeah, there are many different methods to this.
Okay, so I have two questions here. The first, what we're describing here, we're talking about there's this kind of symbol-based way of perceiving. You're seeing a face and you just kind of think face. And then there's this other way of perceiving it where you're just seeing the shape and the lighting or the, I don't know what right words to use here, right? But you're just kind of, you're perceiving the jawline, not as a person's jaw with the symbol in your mind, but just a, you know, a curve that goes like this and then like this and then like this. And you're seeing the outlines of that or the contours. And so you're perceiving it the way you need to replicate that with a pencil on a page or whatever on a page, right? It's just, it's a fundamentally different way of perceiving this thing in front of you. Is that the same thing as this field-based attention where you're focusing on the entire thing? Or is that somewhat of a different dichotomy?
It's related. It's definitely related. I think this whole idea of field-based attention, focus-based attention, detail-oriented, big picture, whatever, you can get caught up in the terms and you start to think that they are two very different things, or that it's very clear, like this black and white. You either think verbally or you think visually.
Yeah.
You either think of the big picture, or you think details. But I think that it's not really like that. I think it's better to think about it in terms of like a different world with different rules, different systems in place. So you're going from one system to a different system, and it's not just two different systems, it's an infinite amount of systems. That book at the beginning, it's very good at showing you those two systems.
Yeah.
But if you graduate from that book, there's so many, you know, you're copying a picture. That's one function of an artist, or copying anything in front of you. You're learning to translate, you know, this line for this line, and you're learning to replicate what you're seeing. But what if you have to draw something where you don't have a reference picture, where you have to create the entire 3D form and then draw that on top? I mean, there's so many different functions you have to go through. One of my artist friends, he's always trying to get me to separate the different functions, the different stages of a drawing, where you start off with, you know, the overall very big basic picture, and then you go to gesture and placement, and then you move on to thinking in 2D, and then once you have that right, then you move on to thinking in 3D space, and then you move on to thinking of form, or then you think of lighting or whatever. Like, you have to move through these different functions. It's not as simple as verbal or nonverbal. It's all these different rules, all these different things. And so yes, it's related, but I don't think it's as simple as a field-based view and, you know, focus-based view. Like, it's just different. It shows up a lot in different subjects as big picture versus details. And I could give examples for that, but yeah, in some way, yeah, I mean, it is the same, but it's...
No, I think I'm with you. I like that point of that there's really so many different processes or ways of thinking that it would be a mistake to just kind of lump them all into this binary, you know, field-based, focus-based, or right brain, left brain, whatever. To me, it feels like there is elements of the field-based attention thing that happen when you're trying to think in contour mode or whatever it's called, not symbol mode, right? Because to me, in the symbol mode of thinking, you're kind of just zoomed right in on one thing. You're like, that's a face, and that's it. When you're trying to understand the lines and see the relationships, pretty much by necessity, you're having to compare a line or a shape to the things that are around it. Like, you're trying to place something in the context of everything all around it, so you have to perceive all of them. So if we're going to try and kind of put labels to these things and divide it up, I'm going to say that the field-based focused attention thing is sort of one dimension here. And then with what we're discussing here, the kind of symbol-based or more, well, whatever the opposite is, the shape contour-based way of thinking, that's sort of this other process that are related, and there's some overlap, but I think that there is a bit of a difference there, and one kind of calls upon the other, but I still think it's worth thinking of them as like kind of separate things.
Yes. Now, okay, so one of the first things you learn when you start trying to replicate things realistically, you know, start to draw what we think of as being an artist, is that idea of seeing the whole picture. And you learn very quickly that that big picture is more important than any detail you could ever draw.
Right.
Like, amateurs, you'll see, they will draw every single hair in the eyebrow. They will draw every eyelash. They'll draw every little... everything, every line between each teeth. You go look at an artist who knows what they're doing, and the eyebrow is just like a couple strokes. Look at some Da Vinci paintings or whatever. There's no individual hairs. It's suggested because they know that the big picture is more important. There are also, there's a name for this, but I don't remember what it is. But you can look at an extremely blurry picture of someone's face and tell exactly who it is. You can almost tell who someone is with like 10 pixels. That's crazy. There's no hair. There's no, like, there's no surface details. But the big picture is there. I mean, that's how our brains work. So you see this big picture. If you want to replicate someone, you have to be able to recognize what that big picture is. And it's very, very difficult. I mean, that's another reason why you always see artists, or you always hear about artists, you know, using their arm to draw and, you know, kind of backing up and using their arm, you know, not the wrist, use the arm. And it's supposed to be like shoulder movements. People make fun of that, but that's the reason why artists do that or encourage that, is because when you're backed up, you can't see those surface details. You have to look at the big picture. And so getting those big gestural shapes and everything, that's you practicing seeing the bigger picture.
Okay, so here's my second question. That totally makes sense. And one of the most impressive things that I've seen, just as my amateur view of art, was somebody somewhere, like on DVD art or something, shared all these portraits of famous people. And I swear it was like 4 or 5 lines. It's just, you know, mouth, side of head, eye, and you knew who it was. Like, oh, that's Harrison Ford, or that's Julia Roberts, who died, or whoever. And it was so, I'm like, I don't even know how I know that. How is it possible that these handful of lines, like, I'm recognizing an actor, and there's hardly anything there. It's just crazy. So, and yeah.
It is crazy.
Yeah, apparently person really gets, like, what is it that defines this person's face, and how do I put that into just a couple of lines?
Yeah, and it's the proportions between things and everything. Like, I mean, yeah. I can talk about it, but actually doing that is very difficult.
Sure.
But you might ask, well, what about the, you know, the portraits that are extremely detailed and also you can recognize who they are? And the way that you're able to do that is from first getting the bigger picture, first getting that recognition down, like, okay, the main thing looks like Harrison Ford, and then you zoom in a little bit, and then you zoom in a little further. And if you do it right, you just layer detail on detail, and you keep that initial big picture in mind, and everything you do on top of that is just a way to reinforce that main thing at the beginning. That's why I do thumbnails before I do a bigger painting. That's why I do these little sketches. It's to figure out the big picture. If it works as a 2-inch drawing, then the chances are when I blow it up, if I am true right. to that, or if I did a good job, then it will transfer over to the final. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. So I love that I brought up something with art, because I feel like you just have a lot of really cool insight to the artist world.
We should probably look at the bigger picture of this episode.
Right.
Yes. What are we talking about? Okay.
Okay. So part of the original question here is the field-based attention less fatiguing than the focused attention? You know, in the context of a classroom, if you're really zoomed in on one kid, paying a lot of attention to them versus kind of seeing, I don't know what this exactly means in the context of a classroom, but you know, you're paying attention to everyone, you're kind of processing all the information, you're seeing the big picture, or you're zoomed in on one thing. So is it more relaxing or less fatiguing to have that big field-based attention than the focused attention? So any thoughts on that from maybe the artist's world type of thing? Like, do you find it more relaxing to be able to kind of see the whole picture at once and that kind of thing? Like, is there...
Okay, let's... I'm trying to think of a good example that isn't art in a classroom setting. But I can't think of cool chemistry examples or something. But okay, let's say you're sitting in a classroom. And the way VST Hero is saying, I imagine him in the classroom trying to listen to a lecture.
I'm not sure. That might be the opposite.
Okay, well, let's just go with that. You are a student in the classroom,
okay,
listening to the teacher give this huge lecture, okay? It's a 2-3 hour long lecture. And you just listen because they demand full attention. They want it totally quiet. Nobody does anything. Just listen to the lecturer drone on and on and on. So you tune out all of these other thoughts, or you're sitting there daydreaming, not paying attention. But let's assume that you are paying attention, but you're bored. You're focused, but you're bored out of your mind. The rest of your brain just kind of goes to sleep and or just dies. Like, it's just off. And you're focused on every word he's saying. And he's like, A plus B equals C. That's the only example I can come up with. And you're like, okay, A plus, what do you say? B equals C. Okay, I got to remember that. All right, so that's the classroom setting. And you just accept these words at face value. And you're just, you know, you copy down exactly what he says, whatever. You don't question it. You don't think twice about it. You're learning this word for word thing. Now imagine you're walking along and one of your friends runs up to you and go, hey, did you know that A plus B equals C? And you're like, well, wait, is that true? Well, what's A? What's B? Wait, are you sure that it equals C? I don't know. The other day I was doing this and whatever. And your whole brain is active and you're thinking about this big picture that just got thrown at you. And you're running through all these different scenarios and you're seeing the big picture. Like, it's this broad, like, full brain activity that's going on. And to me, that is not exhausting at all. Just having fun thinking through this stuff, like playing around, having a conversation, like that is, to me, that sort of overall big picture thinking, which is completely lost when you go into this detail-oriented, okay, you know, memorizing every single word that he's talking about. So that's what came up when I was reading this. Although I could be wrong, but it doesn't matter. What he said.
Like, whether he's teaching the class or in a class, you know, same principle.
Yeah, but you cannot imagine the scenario where your friend just asks you, is, you know, A plus B equals C, whatever. Like, that's not exhausting. That's not fatiguing. That's like, it lights things up in your brain and you are fully immersed in this thing. Well, assuming that they presented it in an interesting way. Yeah. But that's also why I think when you actually enjoy things that you learn, you're using like your whole brain. You're using all these experiences you have, and it doesn't fatigue you. It makes you want more. You get obsessed about it. You get excited about it, and you just want to keep going. It's the opposite of fatigue. Whereas if you sit down with, you know, a really boring textbook and have to go through it word for word and memorize things for a test, whatever, like, and you don't want to do that, that is absolutely fatiguing and awful.
Yeah, if you think about, okay, this friend runs up to you and gives you this equation, A plus B equals C, whatever.
Let's just say they're, you know, second graders.
I don't know, that it has some meaning to it. They say this to you, you will not process that information the way you describe doing it in a classroom, where you're kind of, you're writing down every word the professor says, you're going, okay, I got to remember this fact. And like, you aren't really seeing anything beyond this piece of information you're being fed. And I've been guilty of this. I've witnessed this a lot. That's a very common approach to being in a classroom and learning, is where you're kind of just, the professor says something, you write it down, and you just try to memorize that single fact. So I think what you're saying is totally realistic in that sense.
I'm not giving an example. That was my entire school experience. I failed to ever make connections between the classroom and my actual life. I failed to ever see how it could be important to me. So, yeah, I mean, that was me completely.
Well, you imagine if your friend ran up to you and said something like this, there is no way you would process that information in that way like you would in a classroom. You're going to say, what are you talking about? What is A? What is B? What are we even discussing here? And then they're going to explain it, and you're going to go, well, I don't know if that makes sense because I'm thinking about this or thinking about that. Like, you're totally relaxed. Presumably this is your friend. Yeah. It's just, there's nothing hanging on. You're not being tested. So there's no reason for you to be weird about it and think about it in any strange way. You're just reacting to it. You're thinking, you're making connections. And so because you are relaxed, your mind is able to get way beyond just the simple piece of information you've been given and try and connect that big picture and see how it fits. And this is a major point I want to get to, because I feel pretty strongly about this. I think this is a bit of a two-way street here, in that when you have this broad field-based attention type of thing, you tend to be more relaxed. It is less fatiguing on your brain. But there is the flip side, which is when you are more relaxed, you are less likely to be hyper-focused. You're calm, you're relaxed, and so you tend to think this way. So it is this two-way relationship where,
yeah,
thinking in this very broad mode, trying to keep your attention broad and not hyper-focus on one thing, that helps you relax, but also being relaxed helps you get into this or stay in this mental state. And I think being stressed or being put under stress very quickly will cause your mind to really clamp down on one thing. And that's a totally natural response. We've given this thought experiment before, but somebody walks into your room with a gun, you literally tunnel vision on nothing else matters right now. My attention is fully on this imminent threat to my life. You were designed to do that. Is your focus should draw down very tightly into something very important. If you hear a scary sound in the woods, that becomes the thing that your mind intensely focuses on. Whereas if you're sitting out on the beach and there's nothing to worry about and you're relaxed, you know, it's very easy for your attention to just kind of be broad and open, and you feel relaxed. You aren't fixated on some particular little piece of water off in the distance. Like, you're just seeing everything and you're able to relax that way. So I think there's very much a two-way relationship here.
Well, the goal is not to always see the big picture.
Right.
And it's not to always zero in on details. The goal, or the thing that you're after, is to think about the right stuff at the right time, is to be in the most now it sounds, is to be in the most optimal frame of mind for any situation. Like the guy in the room walks in with a gun or whatever. You want to think about what to do with that scenario. You don't want to think about what you're going to do tomorrow or whatever. It's very important you think about the right thing. Before I went to Portland to visit you, we're getting ready for the flight, and we drive to the airport. And one thing that I overlooked, I overlook a lot of things when I go on trips, whatever, but one major thing I overlooked was making sure that parking was reserved. So we drive to park the car and go, you know, onto our flight, and there's no parking. So we drive to this other place, and there's no parking. So we keep driving around everywhere trying to find parking that's open, or that anybody who has a parking space. And we're running out of time because we had left kind of late, and you know, the flight's getting closer, whatever, and this kind of panic thing. We finally find this one place that has parking, like perfect. So we go there, and it is this little trailer in the middle of a field, and we're almost, I will leave out this, like the rest of the story, even though I felt like I was in an episode of Breaking Bad or something. I was 90% sure that we were going to get murdered. Like, I mean, I was pretty sure, but I figured, okay, we have to park, whatever. Like, it was a really stressful scenario.
Yeah.
Long story short, we eventually make it to our plane and we get on the flight. But it's this very stressful thing where you're thinking about, what do I do? Like, you have to park somewhere, you're whatever. So we park, we get on the plane, and the plane takes off, and we are flying over the United States, the entirety of the United States. And it's this blue sky cloud, like, it's incredible. I mean, I don't understand how people get on planes and just go to sleep or watch a movie. I don't get it. My eyes are glued out the window. I mean, I can't look away. It's spectacular. Like, it is incredible. But I'm flying, and I'm looking out at the United States. And there's just these enormous mountains, and some of them are covered in snow. And then you go to these open fields as far as the eye can see, and there's just these huge clouds above you and in below you in all different directions. And it's just, it's crazy. But you start looking down at the little towns, and there's these tiny little specks that reflect the light. And they're just like, oh, that's a house, I think. Or it's, you know, it's some kind of farm or whatever. Like, there's all these towns, and you're like, oh, that's probably the size of my town or something. And then you just keep flying, and you see another one and another one and another one, and you just see the whole United States. And you start thinking, wow, I don't matter at all. Like, my life doesn't matter. In fact, this entire town that I'm looking at, it could be wiped off the face of the planet right now in front of me, and it wouldn't even seem like a big deal because they're so tiny. You know, like, just wipe off a whole town, nothing matters. And so you just think about this for the next 6 or 8 hours, like, wow, I just don't matter. And then you think about, well, what if I just flew into space and I saw, you know, all of the planet Earth as this little marble? What would that feel like? And then what if you just kept going and you just get, you know, what happens when, you know, planet Earth is the same as a billion other planets? And then you just keep going and going, and there's just these trillions of galaxies and whatever, and it just doesn't end. And I, you know, after the trip, fly again, say, you know, same trip back, and then you land and you're like, you go from this huge zoomed out view of the world, which isn't even as zoomed out as it could be, and then you land in this tiny little airport, and then the airport gets bigger, and then you eventually wind up back in your car, which you couldn't even see from a plane, and you just think, wow. And you think, okay, I could live my life based off of the experience I had in the plane, which is, it doesn't matter at all, like, literally at all. But you don't operate like that. You have to operate in the world that you live in. I mean, I go back to work, I go back home, whatever. This becomes my world again, and I lose the zoomed out, you know, big picture view, which is necessary in order to operate. If I lived my life based on that view, then I wouldn't do anything and nothing would matter, and I'd probably just die or something. And, you know, whatever. Right. Like you have to have the right brain function, or you have to have the right mentality for each scenario. You know, people say, oh, you know, time is relative, it's a human construct or whatever. And it's like, okay, cool, but who cares? Because it doesn't affect my perception. I cannot escape this perception of time as a human. Like, there's no getting out of that. So you have to, you know, carry on with what you actually have. So all I'm saying is you should have the right frame of mind for each different scenario. And I forget what we were talking about, you know, 2 hours ago when I started this story, but in a piece of art, you have to think along the right lines. First, you have to think, okay, I'm going to do a painting in 3 months. And then I'm going to come up with an idea, and that's got to be good. Then you move to the next phase. We're going to do a thumbnail, and then you blow it up, and then you do your research, do your drawing, whatever. But you have to go through each phase and make sure you are in the right mind state for each phase before you move on. And I think that applies to everything.
Yeah. That's beautifully put, and you're totally right that it's all well and good to look at the world and think about how much you don't matter and be totally zoomed out. But then when you're merging onto I-4, you got to focus on.
Right. Yes.
So yeah, 100% agree that the right way to think about if we're trying to build a mental model around this, around these different states of mind and where to be, the right way to think about it is that you want to be in the right mental state for the right amount of time in the right situation and be able to very fluidly move from one to the other. So I have a way less, I have a much more down to earth story experience here. So the past week I bought a game called Cuphead. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. Have you?
Yes. Yeah.
Have you played it?
I haven't played it. Actually, yeah, I have played it. I played it once or twice at work. One of my friends is very into Cuphead, and okay. I admire the game quite a bit. I mean, it's all hand-drawn animation, right? I mean,
yeah. This game, it's really impressive. Like, it's really impressive. It's a game. It's this 2D platformer, bullet hell style game where you're a character, you kind of move around in two dimensions, you can jump, you can dodge, you kind of like shoot by like snapping your fingers and shooting a little bullet. It's that kind of thing. But it's done in this 1930s cartoon style where everything is hand-drawn frame by frame. All the animations are individual frames drawn from one pose to another. It's really, really impressive, and just they nail the style so well, and the sound and the aesthetic and even just the movements and gestures and everything. It's really impressive. Anyway, I picked up this game. It is famously difficult. It's just like all the Steam reviews are people saying, oh, I finally did it, you know, after 10 hours I finally beat the tutorial. Like, okay, it's a hard game. And probably the reason why it's so hard is because it's really, really difficult and time consuming to do all that animation. And so if you make the game easy, you have to make way too much content. So you make it super hard, so it takes somebody a long time to beat it. And you kind of a little bit hide the fact that you don't have that much stuff there. That's actually why all of the old games, like just the original Mario Brothers and stuff like that, were so hard, is because they couldn't fit very much game data onto one of those cartridges. So they didn't want to sell you a game that you would beat in an hour, because then you would be angry, but they couldn't really do much more. So they just made it stupid hard so that it would take you a really long time to beat this game. Anyway, the game's really hard. I picked it up and I'm thinking, I'm not very good at platformer games like this. I remember I bought Hollow Knight and I eventually beat it, but it took me a really long time and it was really difficult for me. I got super stuck at certain points. It was very frustrating. So I'm picking up this game and thinking, you know, we've talked about a lot. We've been through quite a few different, quite a set of ideas on the podcast. I've spent a lot of time playing StarCraft, trying to get better at that and learning things. So like, can I apply some of what I've learned to this game to have a better time, make it easier, not get so stuck? So this game, like I said, very difficult. A lot of people have a lot of trouble. and it went great for me. I beat it a few days ago, and it was hard, like, no question. But I really never got stuck. I never got frustrated, and I never felt like I stopped making progress. Like, I kind of moved through it and beat it. And the game is set up. So let me describe the game, because there's a couple... It really ties into what we're talking about here. Like, this idea of broad attention and everything was something I really paid attention to and made really good use of, I think. So the game, it's almost entirely boss fights. With just a few exceptions, any level, all you really do is you walk into a scene. It's like one screen's dimensions. You usually aren't even moving beyond that single screen of play, and it's a boss. And every boss is different. They're all really hard, and you have to beat the boss. You have 3 health. Anytime you take a hit, you lose 1 health, so it doesn't matter if it's this giant, you know, fireball that the boss fires at you or some random stupid little thing that's wandering around the screen that hits you. You take, you know, 1 health's worth of damage, and you only have 3, and you cannot replenish health. So what that means is that you have to beat this boss, and typically each boss has, like, multiple stages that kind of morph into something harder or crazier, and you can only take 2 hits. If you take 3, you're dead, you got to start the level over. So it's hard. And it, you know, you might be fighting one boss for 5 minutes or so, and there's just all this stuff flying around the screen that's firing at you. There's things ricocheting around, all this, just, there's just stuff everywhere, and everything behaves differently. And you just have to somehow dodge, jump, move, anticipate, never get boxed in. Like, you have to make it through without getting hit more than twice. Okay. So there were a couple things, like, I'm going into this thinking, all right, I really want to try and have the right mind state here and really leverage everything that we've been discussing. So there was a few things that I really worked on and discovered worked extremely well. So one was trying to think of my mind as if it is 2 pieces. And Betty Edwards would call it left brain and right brain. Tim Galway would call it self-1 and self-2. I like the self-1, self-2 division. To me, that's the most useful way of thinking about it. So self-1 being the logical thinking brain, and then self-2 being this non-verbal, innate, you know, not directly accessible part of yourself that's, like, learning and reacting and developing movement patterns and things like that. So for the self-1 part of me, I'm going into this game thinking, I don't want self-1 to be doing a lot of narration. I don't want, you know, the verbal part of my brain going, you suck, you should have dodged that, or I can't believe you failed again. You know, we didn't make it as far as last time, and yeah, you've been doing this for 30 minutes and you're not getting anywhere, like all that kind of stuff. That's not what I want self-1 doing. But self-1 actually has a very important job, in that I do need a logical part of my brain for certain things. So I go into a boss fight, and at the very start, I mean, the game is all this very imaginative, weird animation. Sometimes you're fighting this blob that just, like, you know, bounces around and does weird things, and then it turns into some other random thing, or it grows a giant fist and tries to smash you. Like, it's just, it's totally out there type of stuff, kind of like the old cartoons. So you don't know what's going to happen. Any attack that it does, you don't know how it's going to behave. You know, is it going to shoot something that just flies straight across the screen? Is it going to track me around the screen? Does it, you know, aim to my position but then not change course once I move away? Can I dodge through it? Can I, you know, parry it or whatever, right? So there's all this stuff. So the left side of your, or not the left side of your brain, or whatever, self-1, the logical part of you, its job is to observe things and try and slowly figure out what they do. So every time I start a boss, try to think, okay, what are its possible moves? How many are there? How many different attacks does it have? Okay, it did the fireball attack. You know, does it always shoot 3 fireballs, or does it sometimes shoot 4? Is there a range? What's the timing between them? You know, can I dodge through it if I stand in this part of the screen? What is the hitbox of this attack? There's all this stuff that the self-one part of your brain, like, it's job to figure that stuff out. So that part of me has a task, and that's what it's always trying to do. Gain more information, recognize more movement patterns, you know, categorize things, learn all of that stuff. That's its job. The self two part, the more innate, reflexive, you know, performance thing, the one that's able to execute this complex movement, you know, without conscious thought. It's faster than what you're able to logic through. It's somewhat similar to like Puzzle Storm, where you're looking at something and seeing it. It just lights up for you. That's not a logical thinking part. That's this innate self two part of you. So that part of me, for the most part, I'm trying to set it up to learn and adapt and get better without interfering with it. You know, I'm not trying to bring in a bunch of criticism. I'm not trying to do a lot of hyper analysis. I'm not trying to be angry. I'm trying to set that up. And I'm essentially like feeding it from the left side of my brain, or the self one part of my brain, where I say, okay, when he does this attack, you know, when the devil does his fireball wheel, you know, stand in the middle of the screen, after half of a second, jump up, parry, and then dodge in whichever direction is safer. Like, I'm thinking through what needs to happen. And then I'm just lining that up to where I'm practicing that. So the self two part of me is just learning this movement pattern and trying to execute it and trying to get better at it to where it just becomes reflexive and I'm thinking about other things. So, okay, that's the self one, self two dichotomy relationship here. The other part of it is what we're kind of talking about here, which is this game. I found it to be one of the best. It really made me have to pay a lot of attention to this field-based focus or narrow focus type of problem. Because the game is set up to where you do very little damage to the boss that you're fighting. You know, you're just shooting it constantly and it takes like 5 minutes to kill it. But if you get hit by anything, it's devastating. Like I said, you can only take 2 hits and then you're dead. So really, the game is about dodging. It's about seeing everything on the screen and not letting any of it touch you. That's really the whole game. And it doesn't, like I said, it doesn't matter which attack. Like, if anything hits you, you lose a health and then, you know, you're quickly dead. So what would happen, and this was happening a lot early on, is, you know, the boss does some big attack, it flings some bomb at me or something, and I'm super focused on this thing. I'm like, oh my god, I gotta dodge this. It's really hard to dodge. The hitbox is huge. I'm on moving platforms or whatever. And so I'm like, you know, jump up, go over, and I'm just hyper-focused on this thing. And most of the time, what would happen is I would successfully maneuver around this thing and then take a hit from some other random thing on the screen. There's just stuff flying around everywhere, and that's usually what would hurt me. Like, almost always, I take a hit from something I wasn't paying attention to. So I really started having to pay attention to where is my focus. And there are times, like some very difficult to dodge attack comes at you where you have to focus on that. It really does require all of your focus. It's complex. You know, there's a bunch of moving bits to it or whatever. And so that requires all your focus. But as soon as that moment is over, you're trying to return your focus to the entire screen, where nothing is drawing extra attention. You're just seeing everything, and you aren't dedicating any more attention and focus than need be on one single piece of it. So if there's, you know, some kind of, I don't know, electric zappy panel moving this way, you're trying to see it. You're trying to anticipate its movement. You know where it's going to be. And this isn't even conscious. It's just like this unconscious, okay, here's what's happening. And then you're immediately just letting your focus be on everything else. You aren't paying any undue amount of attention to this particular thing. So I know that's pretty long-winded, but trying to really exercise this relationship between broad focus, see the entire screen, see everything, and then focus intently when I need to, really paying attention to that is a big part of what made the game feel relatively easy to me, where there was the kind of self one, self two, logical brain, innate brain part of it that was a very important piece. But then the other piece was this keeping my focus broad, only tightening it when I need to, and then immediately bringing it back out to being a broad focus. And there's even a name for this, or part of this. It's called an attentional blink. Huberman talks about this a bit. It's like when you're really focused on something and it works, like you successfully dodge, whatever you're testing somebody in. When you successfully identify something, your odds of messing it up in the moments after go way up, because it's like your focus has gotten really tight and it isn't returning to where it needs to be. So anyway, I'm just playing with this and working on this, and it felt so good, and it made the game feel so much more relaxed than it would have been otherwise. Like, I did not get frustrated the way I normally do. I felt like I always made progress, and it really just was this really awesome, like, mental state to be in. So I highly recommend Cuphead to anybody just because it's a great game. And also, it really, like, kind of got me paying more attention than I already have to this, and it worked so well. And so, to bring it back to like the original question, yes, I think having a very broad focus is relaxing. I think that's a major piece of it, but it's not like you're trying to do that all the time. I think what you're really trying to train, and I think train is the right word because it's something that just develops with practice over time, is you're trying to train the ability to not remain in a focus state longer than you need to. Like, the broad focus should be your default. That's where you kind of want to sit. And then you focus down tightly when needed. And then as soon as possible, you bring it right back to that broader focus where you can see the entire screen, the entire classroom, the entire painting, entire whatever. And that's kind of like your rest state.
So I think what we're after here with the question and what this is all about is really just, how do you think the right thoughts at the right time? And your brain does not naturally want to think the right thoughts at the right time all the time. Like, it constantly runs into pitfalls and traps all the time. Especially, random note, near the end of the day. As you become more fatigued throughout the day, you seem to have less and less control over what's important and what you want your focus to be on. But I think that the key or the answer or what we are after is putting systems in place that naturally get you to think the right thoughts at the right time. Let's think about how you do this for the year. I mean, at the end of every year, people start reflecting on what they want out of the next year. So they make all these plans. But then a couple months into the year, sometimes literally just a day or a week, you start getting into the year, and then you get focused on these little details that start popping up in your life, and you completely forget about the big picture of what you wanted out of that year. And then you get to the end of it, and you can't even remember what you wanted to do at the beginning of the year. I mean, we've been doing these quarterly reviews sort of to try to counterbalance that, where we review things every 3 months, and it's helped a lot. And I think what it's shown us is that by the end of 3 months, you're a different person. It takes about 3 months to become someone completely different and lose your priorities that you had 3 months before. And so putting systems like that in place have really seemed to help me. But that's kind of like big life stuff. But there's also just every single project that you go into. Or when I'm at life drawing class, when I start feeling that fatigue or that frustration, I've started to teach myself to back up, to literally like pull my eyes away from the model and look away and just try to see something else, try to focus on something else, try to just refine my bigger picture, refine myself, and then I go back feeling more fresh, and then I go back into it. Oh, okay, so, well, real quick. Another big, I've been noticing this recently in a very big way, in that a couple weeks ago, we uploaded our YouTube videos, whatever. Well, since then, I've been really focused on, and I'm okay with this, but I've been very focused on the social media aspect of all the stuff I'm trying to do. So I'm looking at my website. I'm trying to learn a bit more about Instagram and figure out what I actually want to do on Instagram and you know, maybe a Patreon, whatever. So I'm trying to think about all this social media stuff. But, and this goes into it not being so black and white of focused or unfocused or whatever. It's just these different systems. I've been completely consumed with this social media stuff that I'm having a hard time pulling myself out of that. I also finished a painting in this time period, and that means I need to start the next one. So I started thinking about the next one, but my brain is so connected to all the social media stuff. I start thinking in terms of social media. I start thinking in terms of Instagram and whatever. And so my artistic choices start being poisoned by this other system. And so I've had to just like, okay, I have to stop everything, completely detox from all this other stuff and find myself in the art again and then start making decisions, because I can't make the right decisions if I'm thinking about the wrong thing. I mean, if you think about like a pilot or something, the pilot should not be thinking about, you know, are the floors clean or whatever. The pilot should not be concerned with any, you know, small tasks on the plane. They should be thinking about the big picture. Are we getting to wherever we need to go? You know, what's the weather, whatever. Like, are they listening to the right data? They have a specific set of information that they need to be focused on. And to focus on anything else would be catastrophic. And I think it also applies to anytime you do something where you... Well, that's what I'm running into right now, is if I start thinking about social media stuff when I'm trying to do art, it will be catastrophic. Not quite as catastrophic, but it will be a massive failure on my part. So I have to make sure that I'm thinking about the right things at the right time. Like, it's okay to think about social media stuff, but I have to do that in a very separate space and start identifying what things I need to be thinking about at what times.
Yeah, I feel like, so just in this spectrum between broad focus and tight focus, I think that probably the way that we're wired to operate made a lot of sense pre-modern society.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there was no social media, there was no anything. You know, if something threatening happened, your focus would be drawn down to that. You're hunting an animal, you're being hunted by an animal, there's somebody who wants to kill you, that type of thing, like tight focus. Outside of that, you're sitting around in your cave, drawing pictures on the wall or something. Like, you're in this completely different state of mind where there really likely isn't anything that's trying to draw your focus down that way. And so you're kind of tuned for that, I imagine. In that your focus is very broad and you're somewhat relaxed and you have this sort of binary state. But it, again, just with this silly example of me playing this game, the game is designed to feel very intense, and there's these things that are happening, and of course it's just a game and it's silly and cartoony, but it feels threatening. Like, I can feel myself physically react to when I'm like, oh my god, I'm about to take a hit. And that, like, that high tension aspect of the game causes or very much tries to bring my attention very tight. And that's just kind of the natural state of me. Like, that's how my mind and body react to this thing that I'm doing, is that my attention keeps getting drawn down to being very focused. And that's not, again, it's not a bad thing, but it it's disproportionate to what needs to happen. Like, once I've navigated the fireball, my attention needs to become very broad And it's like it gets kind of stuck. Like that's the mismatch between my natural state and how I need to operate to be able to get through this game and succeed at it. So I'm having to take this conscious intervention to purposefully broaden my focus. I'm continuously reminding myself and practicing that change of, as soon as I've resolved the situation, broad focus again. Let's see everything that's on the screen. Let's, you know, give as much attention as is needed to these things and no more. So I'm just essentially trying to balance all of that stuff, but it's not natural. It's not something that just happens instinctually. There is this mismatch between the way I'm kind of wired and what's happening on the screen. So to me, that's the key thing, is to try and recognize where you're out of whack. And technically, with what we're describing, this sort of broad focus, narrow focus, like you could be too much of either, yeah. Right? It could be that you're always stuck in broad focus and you can't draw your focus down to something specific when you need to. But I think a good comparison would be kind of like eating, in that you can eat too much and you can also eat too little. And there very much are people who don't eat enough, like they are underfed. But the more common problem is to be overfed. Most people are trying to lose weight. They aren't trying to gain weight, right? That's just kind of the nature of society and the environment that we live in. So I think there's a good parallel here, in that most of the time we get stuck in hyper-focus mode. There's so much that's so stimulating and causes us to be intensely focused. And we kind of value that too. We tend not to think so much about the flip side of being able to broaden your focus, that's where most people are. So most people benefit, certainly me as much as anyone, benefit from training and practicing this broader focus and being able to stay in this broader focus a higher percentage of the time. And very much, I feel like being able to do that keeps me much more relaxed, and I don't build up the same kind of fatigue. If I let myself just get super focused and really fixated on something, I burn out very fast. I lose my ability to be in any kind of broad focus. Like, I can't make good decisions anymore. I get sucked down into stuff. Sometimes it's not even that I can't recognize that I'm spending time in the wrong thing. Sometimes, often, it's so bad that I know I'm spending time on the wrong thing, and I just can't get myself to get away from it. Like, it's a wild thing, but that happens quite a lot. I'm like, this is wrong, this is dumb, this is not valuable. I should not be spending an hour trying to figure this out, but I literally can't stop. Like, that's the cost of this sort of overactive hyper-focus. So I think there's huge value in trying to train this other part of it. And one more thought on this. I think it's something that you can practice and you can just work on, but I think it really, really helps if you can try and find, like you said, find specific things that kind of make this happen for you. Flip the painting upside down, put yourself in a different environment, whatever you can do to try and get your focus to broaden. Try the magic eye auto stereogram thing. Like, that can really help.
One thing that I've been doing a lot recently, which has been working wonders for me, I think, is I have found the value of feedback from the right people at the right times is just completely invaluable. So with me trying to, you know, come up with ideas for my art and sort of, you know, this rough storyline, whatever, develop this world type thing, I'm doing something I've never really done before and I don't know much about. And I'm just like, I have jumped full force into this thing and I'm just sort of scatterbrained with it. And so what I've realized is that I need to talk to people. I need to get some feedback. So I called up a week ago or something. I called up one of my writer friends, and he develops like IPs develops like world building type stuff. It's like right in line with what I'm trying to do. And I was just, you know, talking to him, and I'm like, hit me with questions, like try to destroy what I've just described to you. Like try to trip me up, poke holes in what I'm doing. And he did. And he's asking me these questions and I'm like, I don't know the answer to that. And it was just, it was so good. I mean, it was so great. And then also, like I was about halfway through the painting that I just finished and I was getting stuck. I was getting lost in all these details. I'm, you know, among many things, I'm thinking, oh God, the tree in the background, is that right? Is that wrong? I don't even see it as a thing anymore. Like it's just this weird symbol or something. I don't know. I can't see it anymore. Like I'm totally blind. I'm totally lost in these details. And so I share the painting on some art discords for, you know, like critique channels. And a couple people, they give me some really great feedback and they point out a couple different artists. Some of them point out the same things and some of them point out totally different things, but none of them pointed out, you know, the stuff I was thinking that was so wrong, that was ruining the piece. Yeah. They didn't even notice it or care or it wasn't important at all. And I'm thinking, oh God, you're right. Like my priorities have totally, gone totally, you know, completely off course. I've been focused on these weird details that really truly do not matter. It's like, you know, trying to draw in the eyebrow on somebody's portrait. It just, the individual right. hairs don't matter. But when you get into the details, you think they matter so much. And then once you stand back, you realize it doesn't look like even a person. So getting this feedback has been amazing. I've also been talking to one of my graphic designer friends and I've been showing her like, this is what I have in mind. Like, this is what I'm thinking. And then she's poking holes in it. And it's like, ah, this is so good. Like if you can get over yourself and open yourself up to that type of feedback at the right times and have the right attitude towards it, it's like, it's exactly what I've been needing. And I plan on doing that more and more. So getting feedback has been a way for me to step back and see things the way other people see them or see them from a different viewpoint and sort of rip myself out of the weeds or out of the details that may not matter at all.
Yeah. One thing that I've kind of along those lines that I've found to be really helpful. Well, I mean, everybody knows this, but I'm playing Cuphead, right? And this is all I'm going to talk about because I just beat it. So it's just what's on my mind. But I find that I get this sort of window where I can fire it up, I can play, and at some point, things just don't get better. You know, I'm fighting this boss, I can make it 20% through, and then 25% through. I can feel myself starting to adapt and understand, like I'm recognizing more patterns, I'm doing better, I'm kind of executing different moves and things correctly. But after, I don't know, an hour, hour and a half, it's like, it doesn't really get better anymore. And maybe I can use that self one part of me to, you know, recognize more patterns and kind of get that like logical part to learn more things. But the reflexive part of me is just kind of done. Like it's not really yeah. adapting anymore. And I start to get more and more frustrated. And I think there's a few things happening, but one of them is that when you're focused on something for an extended period of time, it's almost as if these certain parts of your brain or things that you're seeing, it's kind of like, I don't know. It's like when you bite your lip and then you just keep biting it over and over because it's like kind of swollen a little bit. And it's like your mind just starts to really get hooked on certain things. And no matter how much you're trying to kind of pull it back and see the broader stuff, it just gets harder and harder because you're more and more, you're just kind of drilling down into these things and getting this like hypersensitivity almost. And so when you step back for an extended period of time and really let all of that cool off to where, you know, I come back the next day and fire it up, it almost feels a little bit foreign right at the start. It's like, oh man, what were the buttons again? How do I do this again? Like there, everything is kind of faded out, but that's a good thing because you bring it back up again. It takes a few minutes to kind of warm back up to what you're doing, but everything has calmed down where I'm not hyper focused on certain things and I'm able to kind of see everything in the big picture mode again. And then typically what will happen is after a few minutes of kind of warming up to it, it's like I get into this next session where now I'm getting farther. I'm getting this boss to 75%, or maybe I'm beating it and going to the next one. But it's like I can expect a lot more progress out of this next window up to the point where it starts to fall off again, and then I need to right. step away. And I imagine there's something kind of similar happening with an art project or anything else where you... I mean, VST Hero is talking about a classroom setting. This is not a great answer, but to me it's like if you're getting burnt out after 2 hours, maybe you just, you know, 2 hours is kind of the limits of what you can yeah. do. That may not be practical, so maybe you do have to look for any ways of making that 2 hours feel less draining, right? And that's part of what we're talking about. But at the same time, it's like, man, if you can get up and get away and let your mind cool off,
yeah,
that might be the thing to do.
Well, one more example. When I used to write music a lot, I could never finish a song and never put anything out there, which is why it eventually crashed and burned and I never did anything with it. But I never finished a song because I would get so obsessed about every single note. And I would end up with 30 yeah. different versions of the same song. And I listen back to them now and think, what the hell were you thinking? They're all exactly the damn same. Like, they're the same song 30 times. And at
yeah.
you know, back then, I thought that it made all the difference because I wanted it to be perfect or whatever. But it just, if you look at the big picture of that song, they're all the same. Like, they're doing the same thing. They mean the same. There's no big impact changing. It's just my brain was fixating on things that did not, like, literally didn't matter at all. And that was stupid. And it ruined me. So, yeah. But okay, we should probably wrap this up because if I'm thinking of the bigger picture of my life, I need to go to sleep and not stay up all night doing this. So,
fair enough. Okay, any like wrap up? Last we just did a 20-minute wrap up, which doesn't count.
It's
1 minute yeah, wrap up.
I like to think of it less as you're always trying to see the bigger picture. You're always trying to back up because that's not the case. You're not always trying to be, you know, broad spectrum, and you're not always trying to be super focused, detail oriented. You're trying to think the right things at the right time. You're trying to look to the correct information when you need to make a specific decision. So you need to be thinking about the right things. And I don't know, if you think about this in terms of like these different systems, and you need to make sure each system is set up right. I don't know. I think that helps me a little bit rather than thinking of it as this black and white, focused or not focused or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And if I had one piece of advice, it would be practice the transitions that you think you're bad at.
Yeah.
But in my case, I'm bad at bringing my attention broad. Like, I get stuck. And so practicing not so much always maintaining that broad focus, because as you said, that's not really what's needed. There's very often you need to be narrowly focused. But for me, practicing quickly returning to that broad focus as soon as the need for the narrow focus is over. And again, as you're saying, like, it's not quite as yeah. black and white as that. It's a spectrum and there's different aspects of this, so like don't oversimplify into that, but just as a basic mental model, I think that's been super useful for me.